Listen to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence on FNX. I'm your host, Stel, and I've got two co-hosts with me this evening. It's none other than Yannickis J, who's returning after... Actually, no, you were on last week, weren't you?
It was so memorable
that I completely forgot that you were on. How you doing?
Thanks a lot, mate. I appreciate that. I'm good. How are you? You alright?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm just glad you didn't take offence to that, because you take offence to everything else I seem to say to you, so...
I'm used to it. You and Rod are like, you know, you've made me stronger.
Isn't that a song? I'm sure it's a song.
Probably. It's not another Michael Jackson theme, is
no,
it?
No. It's sure as hell isn't Shania Twain, so don't worry about it. Right, my second co-host is none other than the former Canadian national team men's head coach, Michael Finley, returning to the show. How you doing, mate?
Really good, guys. Really good. Nice segue there, by the way. Shania Twain being Canadian.
Oh, really? Is she?
Yes.
No
yes,
way.
Indeed, very. Yeah, you should have taken responsibility for that, but that's fine. Yeah. So thank you for the segue. Great to be here.
No, great to have you back. I didn't know she was from Canada. I thought she was from Texas for some reason.
No. She just acts like a Texan.
All right.
From Ontario.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
That was your chance to be famous. You know, not famous as in to you know. I don't know what I'm saying. Let's just carry on.
No. Please elaborate, because I need to know how to get famous.
Well, I think to impress Michael that Shania Twain was Canadian anyway.
Yeah. Listen, the only famous Canadian singer I could think of is... what's her name? My Heart Will Go On. What's her name? Celine Dion. Brian Adams?
Okay, quick. Brian Adams?
Yes.
Sarah McLachlan?
Never heard of her.
Oh, you should look her up.
I might do now.
Very impressive. Very, very, very impressive.
Okay.
Diana Krall, the jazz pianist.
Okay.
Very famous, again. Maybe not on your Spotify playlist.
Let's put it that way. No, she's not on mine. I don't think she's on Yan's either.
You can have a Canadian file, and you can just... dump all the Canadians in there.
Yeah, could do that. But listen, there's loads of famous Canadians. I mean, you got loads of Canadian wrestlers like the Bret Hitman Hart. There's another one called Chris Benoit. You're not allowed to mention Chris Benoit, but for these reasons.
We are famous for our exports in many ways.
Yes, that's true. That's true. And you gave us the central defender that used to play for Spurs, wasn't it? Obviously from New Zealand. I forget his name now. Jan, help me. Central defender from Spurs back in the mid-2000s when we won the double 2008.
Roman Vega?
No, he's from Switzerland.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. He's not Canadian. He's got to be New Zealand.
Nielsen, that's it. Nielsen.
Nielsen, who became a coach.
He was a coach in Canada, wasn't he? He was
the TFC coach.
That's right. He played for the New Zealand national team at the World Cup, didn't he? That's right.
Correct.
So I got my football knowledge isn't as great as what I make it out to be, but I get by. No. I haven't had any death threats for a while, so no. I'll probably get them now from his family, though.
Yeah. Roman Vega was Swiss. He scored an own goal for us, didn't he? When we beat him 2-0.
That's right.
Yeah.
He was a good defender, though.
Yeah, it was alright.
I think he's an accountant now, if I'm not mistaken, or a property manager or something like that. He's doing pretty well for himself.
It's probably earning more than what he did at Spurs at that time.
Yeah. You never know. But hey.
Yeah, I don't think you have to worry about him. I read an article on him once. I don't think you need to worry where his next meal's coming from.
Right, yeah, but he's not on I'm getting names tonight. What's wrong with me? Flamini, yeah.
See,
original. Yeah. Flamini is on a different pay scale, isn't he?
Yeah. He's like one of the richest footballers, isn't he?
Yeah. That's right. He's doing pretty well for himself. But yeah, Ramon Vega, he's Swiss Asset Management. So he's doing very well for himself. Yeah. Congratulations to the guy. Played for Celtic. Played for Celtic as well. But again, I don't think the Celtic fans would be too happy when he left them for Watford. Not that they were with Brendan Rodgers when he went to Leicester, but we'll go into Brendan in just a bit.
That, won't we? Yeah.
Exactly. Wow, we've just done 6 minutes of randomness. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. So I think I'm going to name this show Stealth Forgets His Lines or Stealth Fluffs His Lines.
Yeah, so did I at the beginning, so you can call it the Fluff Show.
No, we can't call it that. If you Google Fluff Show, you might get a different... Yeah, let's not go into that. It's not that kind of show. Not that kind of show. Right, let's talk about the football then. And North London Derby, wasn't it? And it wouldn't be a North London Derby if there wasn't any controversy. Spurs went into the game on the back of two straight defeats, while Arsenal were full of confidence having smashed Bournemouth 5-1 in midweek. Now, I'm going to try and summarise this game in under a minute, so get your clocks out or your stopwatches. Arsenal should have taken the lead within 2 minutes, but Lacazette snatched his shot wide. Aaron Ramsey then broke away in the 16th minute to open the scoring and celebrated by pointing to the ground, yelling, "This is my effing pitch," and we all know why. Bernd Leno's double save kept Spurs at bay until Mustafi bundled Harry Kane over in the box and the England striker scored the resulting penalty. Now, truth be told, the penalty shouldn't have been given as Kane was offside in the build-up. Referee Anthony Taylor was having a bit of a nightmare, like me today, as not only did he fail to spot Davinson Sanchez's stamp on Laurent Koscielny, he awarded a very soft penalty to Arsenal in the final minute. Up stepped Aubameyang to win the game, but he totally, here we go, fluffed his lines. And Lloris had a pretty easy save to make. I did that in under a minute. I think most women would be quite unimpressed by that. Jan, have I missed anything? Torreira's red card.
Torreira's red card, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, listen, in all seriousness, this was a typical North London derby. Both teams were well up for it and they didn't lie down and they didn't let the neutral down. Which of the two do you think are happy to take a point now, mate?
I'd probably say Tottenham.
Yeah?
Yeah, on the day, yeah. I know it sounds silly, you know, I think Tottenham overall are a better side than Arsenal, but I was quite impressed by Arsenal. The way they had their shape, how they set up their store, how they tried to hit Tottenham on the counter-attack, which they did with Ramsey's goal. I thought Arsenal were pretty comfortable during the course of the game, apart from Leno's kind of double save. I don't recall Tottenham having too many chances. Obviously, the penalty was a penalty, but it shouldn't have been a penalty because Kane was offside. And then Arsenal had the chance to win it at the end with Aubameyang with the penalty, but also the rebound as well. I mean, you've got to give Jan Vertonghen enormous credit.
Yeah.
You know? I think Emery as well justifies why he doesn't play Ozil in big games. He came on and did absolutely nothing. He was anonymous on the pitch. I mean, the momentum swung a little bit Tottenham's way once Ozil came on because he just offered nothing. And I think Emery's probably right when he doesn't play him in the big games, because when he doesn't play, he's got a solid shape. He's got players that would run for him. And Ozil just doesn't seem interested. I mean, I know it was a cameo kind of 15-20 minute appearance, wherever it was. But even then, for a player of his stature to kind of offer nothing, for him was very disappointing. As for Tottenham, I think Tottenham looked leggy. They looked tired. I think all the games that they've played so far are starting to show. Even though it was a derby, you could tell Tottenham were lacking a little bit of confidence with recent results. And for me, they were fortunate to get a point on Saturday.
Mm. Michael, I just want to take a quick step back because I've got a question to ask you about Spurs' resilience. But let's talk about Mesut Ozil. And I know people are going to be sighing and saying, "Oh, not this subject again," because you see all over Twitter, Arsenal fans arguing about Mesut Ozil. But you've coached at the highest level, mate. How do you deal with someone like Mesut Ozil? Because as Jan said, he's a very talented player. But when it comes to the big games, he shies away. And I can't remember the last time he actually stepped up in a big game. Possibly Chelsea last season or the year before when Conte was in charge.
Yeah, he's such an enigma, you know, and there, you know, I don't think anybody's going to doubt, you know, his ability and his influence on an overall pattern of games. It seems that when you're really looking for him, he does disappear. You know, if you want to go on the data side of the analysis of his performances, you know, it's quite good. And you look at the amount of activity he's had, and contributions he had to the club and to the team in a lot of games, it's very high. And you can see why he demands the attention, the wages he does. But there is always going to be an asterisk on Mesut, and it's because he has not, at the end of the day, dragged them across the line. And I think the evaluation of a player of his supposed stature are the ones that end up dragging the rest of the team across the line with their ability. How he's being treated right now, I don't think you can argue not being inside or in behind the scenes, but I can't see arguing not playing him in these types of games. And it'll be interesting to see how things evolve. There's no doubt, too, that teams need to be built specifically around what Mezet offers. And if you don't have that type of team, you know, he becomes quite a pedestrian in the process.
That's right. And it baffles me how a footballer can cause such division with the fans. You know, I don't know if you've seen it on social media.
Yeah.
There are many Arsenal fans that love him and there are many that despise him. And it baffles me how a player has so much power these days. In fact, to be fair, I can't really talk because United had it with Pogba under Jose Mourinho and a lot of fans were backing Pogba and a lot of fans were backing Jose Mourinho. So it just shows how much of an influence these footballers can have on teams these days. But again, I want to take another step back to the double save from Leno. I know a lot of people think those two saves were fantastic. I think the first one was straight at him, was an easy one to make. No, it wasn't an easy one, but it was pretty standard. But the second one, where he reacted to it, again, strong hand, fair enough. But that's the kind of save that you'd expect him to make, given the fact that in goalkeeper training, that's something that they really do, isn't it? When the goalkeeper's on the ground, they usually pump the ball to see how quick his reactions are. So it's basically something that he's used to doing day in, day out in training, is it not?
Yeah, I think you're right. First and foremost, the first one was sort of right at him. And I think if you were going to assess the ability to do it, it was how he was able to reset himself. That was, you know, if you look at the way his body language and his momentum went, he had to reset himself to put him even in the position to get his hand on the second one. But yeah, I mean, it's a great save because it doesn't go in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If it had gone by him by 3 or 4 inches, nobody would be talking about it. There's no doubt, though, it shows the strength that he has too, and to be able to single-handedly, you know, deflect the ball in that position. But yeah, I mean, I think it was a great moment of football and excitement, and quite frankly, you know, it gave Spurs a little bit of an opportunity to right some wrongs in the first half, potentially, and it may have spurred them on a little bit going into the second half.
Mm, absolutely. Well, you mentioned Spurs, and I want to talk to you about their resilience, because it's been absolutely remarkable the way they clawed their way back into games. But I'm sure they'll be very relieved that Arsenal were wasteful in front of goal.
Well, I totally agree, and you know, full disclosure that we've talked about before, you know, I am an Arsenal supporter, I'll say it, and admirer. But I have to say that, you know, in terms of Spurs, I mean, the first half performance, I don't think anybody's going to debate, it was very poor. I mean, they dominated possession. I thought that, you know, they held the tempo relatively well, but they never really created any chances. They never had any really critical actions in the right spots. I was really concerned before the game because I really didn't like how Arsenal looked like they were going to set up. And to Jan's point, you know, and proven wrong, I was quite impressed with the way they applied themselves, specifically in how they set up in their block to deny these opportunities. But I thought Spurs were going to try and take advantage of some of the wide situations, which I thought were suspect in how he played. But they didn't do that. But luckily, you know, at the end of the day, they've had a much more impressive second half. They were a little bit more on the front foot. They were breaking some lines and they started to create things. You know, at the end of the day, I agree. I think I'd be happy if I was Spurs getting away with it. But I also agree. I thought it was a very weak penalty at the end, to be fair. But yeah, I think they should be very pleased. But I have to say something about Spurs too, is that, you know, I was having a conversation today with another individual about this, and when you look at the Spurs organization right now, and you look at the amount of moving pieces that are happening within that club, from off-field, administratively, future planning, and you look at the risk reward scenario as it relates to the investment they made in the club. You've got to applaud Spurs as they sit in third place. In my opinion, I think they've done an enormously impressive job given everything that's affecting the club and time at this moment. You know, including their Champions League run.
No, absolutely, I agree. And yeah, gents, I'm going to ask you both this question. At the risk of mentioning VAR, what was your initial reaction when Spurs were awarded a penalty? Do you think Kane was offside? Because for me, when I first saw it, immediately, even before the ball went in the box, he was standing in an offside position anyway.
Yes, I agree. Even with the naked eye, I didn't need the replay. I knew it was offside.
I think there was more than one player offside in that one, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it happened in the first half as well when Kane scored the header, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which, by the way, what a header it was. No one really mentioned the fact that it's come off him, and he just hasn't let it bounce off him. He's directed it with pace in the top corner. I was like, wow. And then, you know, everyone forgets because they're talking about the offside. But it was a lovely piece of skill.
Yeah, it was one of those headers where he didn't actually need to put any power behind it because the momentum of the ball was just spot on. So he just, as you said, he just had to redirect it. Yeah.
Man. Do you know what? I know it was only a penalty as well, but you got to give Kane credit as well for taking the penalty as well. Spurs weren't having the greatest day, and you know he stepped up and he scored the penalty as well quite comfortably. So you know you got to give him full credit for that as well.
But he's one of those players that when you do have a penalty in that kind of situation, he's the
you
first.
You trust him?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think the only one he fluffed that I could recall was at Anfield, wasn't he? When he tried to put it down the middle, was it last year when Wanyama scored that screamer? And then he had the second penalty when he scored last minute to get a draw.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, I think that's the only one I can recall that he's missed maybe a big penalty at a big situation. But even in the World Cup for England and, you know, even on Saturday, he's the man for these occasions. And, you know, harsh call to send Leno, you know, the wrong way.
Yeah, hasn't he got 8 Derby goals now? Is it 8 or 9? So he's
I think it's 8. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Well, then Arsenal should have just asked him to take the penalty at the end, then they would have won.
Yeah, yeah.
It just shows what a big player Harry Kane is, though, for Tottenham and what he is as an individual. I think if he moved from Spurs and he went to any club, that club is going to benefit massively because, you know, not only is he a great striker, he's actually a really good player where he can link up play and he scores all types. For me, he's like the modern Alan Shearer.
Yeah,
you know that's the way I see it.
He's probably getting the same protection as Alan Shearer did as well.
that's right.
The other thing that you notice about him too is, you know, for the, you know, sort of the makeup of him physically, you know, he plays quite well with his back to goal. Even though his, you know, his greatest attribute is when he's inside the frame and he's coming onto things, but when he plays with his back to goal, there's only a few players who are very comfortable, you know, pressure in behind, but he also deals with pressure the second and the third man really well. So he's a great ball protector, and that's why, you know, you have so much success with them when they do link together up high. He can hold it up, but he can also hold it up and he can manipulate it into the right areas, even with, you know, a 2v1 situation. I thought he looked a step slow on the weekend. I think he's still coming back into his pace, but I think he's incredibly valuable for the club and going forward. I think he's key to them.
I'm just going to put it out there. I don't think he will make the same mistake Alan Shearer did. I think he will leave to join a club where the opportunities to win trophies are higher. I know Alan Shearer doesn't regret joining Newcastle. He says, you know, he dreamt of scoring in front of the Gallagher end, you know, all the famous number nines and all that, your Jackie Milburns and whatnot. But I still believe that, you know, Harry Kane has got so much to offer. And if a Real Madrid or a Juventus or a bigger club come in for him with the opportunities to win titles, Champions Leagues, I think you'll see Alan Shearer and say, right, Shearer's got the Premier League goal scoring record. That doesn't mean anything for me. I want to win trophies. And, you know, Shearer only got one trophy in his whole career, which was the Premier League title at Blackburn.
That's right.
A key time in his career is coming up, because if that move is on, that move's coming very soon.
Oh, absolutely. With
he could be loyal to Tottenham, but how loyal can you be if he's got any ambition, like you said, to better himself also as a footballer and to win trophies? You know, he's got to move, because let's face it, Tottenham, they're building a new stadium and they've got places, but if they're going to do what Arsenal have done over the years, then Tottenham are not going to progress, are they? So, you know, and Real Madrid are looking for a striker, so you never know if you can make the move in the summer.
Well, look, this is a pivotal season for Spurs, because if they don't qualify for the Champions League going into that new stadium, I mean, let's be 100% honest, right? We've seen how Arsenal have kind of struggled since moving into their stadium. But let's be honest, the money that was involved in football back when Arsenal moved to the Emirates wasn't as much as what it is now. You qualify for the Champions League, that's what you're guaranteed, 60 million. I mean, that's a big amount of money. Now, if Spurs don't get into the Champions League, I don't know. I mean, Kane could be leaving sooner rather than later. I don't know. That's just me. Anyway, I know a lot of Spurs fans are probably going to disagree with me. But hey,
I think because of the stadium, there might be a few of the players that might just want to stick around to play one season, then see how it goes. And then after, maybe make the decision.
I don't know. I just don't think these players owe the club anything. You know, if Christian Eriksen wants to leave, I wouldn't be surprised if he joins Real Madrid or Barcelona in the summer, the way that both clubs are really preparing themselves for a big transitional period. And let's be honest, you know, Real Madrid have been really stuck in a rut this season. Luka Modric is on the wrong side of 30. He's a perfect replacement, is he not?
Well, I think at the end of the day, he's got to be on the high target list. There's no doubt about that. I do believe, though, that the stadium situation and the economics of that, along with the fact that they did not invest money into this team in the beginning of the year, I think they might have a little bit of a window of opportunity to try and keep them based on maybe some promises and some ideas and the fact that they're moving into the stadium. But I think the Champions League qualification is probably the critical point for that to actually work.
Yeah, I agree. Well, Michael, let's talk about your Arsenal. I'm sure they'll be kicking themselves after throwing away their chance of taking all 3 points at the end. Do you think Lloris did his homework? I know Aubameyang put his penalty in the same spot when they last met in the league.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, it's very rare at this level these days that their preparation hasn't been done. The access to data and the access to video and being able to package it well, probably with the goalkeeping coach. I'll go out on a limb and say, yeah, he's done his homework, but I'll also go out on a not go out on a limb and just tell you it was an absolutely shocking penalty.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was going that way. And I think he almost thought I almost could overcompensate and dive right by this. So in terms of that, you could say both things, but at the end of the day, the football gods were kind of there also, because I think we just mentioned, I didn't think it was a penalty to begin with. And if I'm being honest about it, I think the match itself probably deserved a saw-off as it ended up. And I think it would have been a pretty cruel way. I can't believe I'm actually saying this, but a cruel way for Spurs to lose. But I'm trying to be as neutral as possible. So for me, yeah, absolutely, he's probably done his homework. But more importantly, it really was a shocking penalty.
I'm going to throw a couple of things out there. First of all, I think the referee, someone had a word in his ear and said that equaliser was offside. You know, the foul on Harry Kane. And I think he needed an opportunity to even it out and give Arsenal that goal. That's what I think anyway. That's my first prediction. That's what I'm throwing out there. The second one.
Conspiracy theories.
My second one, and you might agree with this one actually. I think Aubameyang changed his mind at the last minute where he's going to put it. Because if you saw the way that he was huffing and puffing, he looked nervous. I think originally he wanted to just slam it down the middle. But I think he knew that the goalkeeper was anticipating it. So he changed his mind and decided to go where he normally puts it. And that's kind of, obviously, when they say you can't change your mind at the last minute, I don't know, because I've never taken a high pressure penalty, but it just seemed to me that he wasn't confident in the build up to the penalty. What do you reckon, Jan?
I agree, and I agree with Mike as well. I thought it was an extremely poor penalty. it was obvious where he was going to go. The penalty had really no power towards it as well.
He didn't look confident, Yang. That's not a penalty from someone that's confident. He's going to lash at that ball if he's confident. But the way they just hit it, it was just almost as if like he knew he was going to miss. Yeah. No, I don't even say that. I just think that he just wasn't confident. If you watch the build-up, before he runs up to take the penalty, he's looking down, he's you know, heavy breaths, he's nervous. You can tell it was a high-pressure situation, and he bottled it.
I think most players would be nervous, though, in a situation like that.
Well, Harry Kane wasn't.
Harry Kane
wasn't. Raheem Sterling wasn't.
Sorry?
Raheem Sterling wasn't.
Yeah, but an inch above, and he hits the bar, Raheem Sterling. So
if some buts.
You can argue say it's a great pass. I mean,
if Marnie had balls, she'd be my uncle.
Yeah, but if Lloris goes the other way and Aubameyang scores, you'll say, oh, what a lovely penalty because he sent the keeper the wrong way. All right, because Lloris has gone the right way and it just makes him look foolish because the penalty looks rubbish, basically. But I do agree with you that it did look really nervous. He did look confident. Maybe the fact that he was on the bench though as well, that he came on, maybe that's something that had to do with it.
Or like Jamie Vardy.
Yeah, that's a good point. Possibly. I just think a little bit more power. He needed more power on the pen.
I think the changing the mind comment, I would also lean towards that, and you're right. It's sort of written in the PK manual that if there's one thing you don't do is change your mind, and look at you. I mean, we go back to the Harry Kane penalty. You know, he's very automatic. I mean, you look at his breakdown. He's had a couple of different spots, but he's probably, if you look at who he was playing against, it's probably relatively close to what that keeper does on an ongoing basis, but his execution was clinical. Like, you know, the ball had pace, it was going in, and as you say, still, he just didn't look like he was up to it. I'd probably say he did change his mind.
Absolutely. Well, joining us right on time, actually, Rodri Giggs. How you doing, Rod?
Yeah, I'm okay. You all right, pal?
Yeah, good, mate. Good. Great to have you back on. How you doing?
Hey, Jan, you all right?
You're all right.
Yeah, hi, Michael. You okay?
All good, my friend. All good.
Good.
Great stuff. What pie are you eating this time?
No pie. Too late for all that now.
he's got a game tomorrow.
Yeah. Too late. Sits on my stomach. So too late for all that now.
Fair enough. Talk to me about Lucas Torreira's red card, Rod. Was that the right decision?
Yeah, in today's world, it was. You know, when you dangle your leg like that, your straight leg, or you know, it's anything high or above ground level, you know, it's ultimately a red card and ultimately the right decision. So you know, it's really in a real world, it'd be a yellow card, but you know, it's reckless, it's dangerous. In today's world, it was a red card and ultimately the right decision, and really didn't ultimately affect the game, but you know. You don't really want to be sent off at last couple of minutes, but you know the referee had no decision really to make, but to send him off, and that's what he did.
Mm-hmm. It affects the game on Sunday, though, doesn't it? Because he's suspended for the United game.
Yeah, well, that helps us out, but it didn't affect the game. as the game on the day, but yeah, it obviously affects them because he's a big part of what they do. He's a little Terry. He wins ball, does the ugly things, and. And a player that will definitely be missed on Sunday, but for me, I'm happy that he's not playing. So
yeah. Same, yeah, mate.
Mm. Yeah, and talk to me about Davinson Sanchez. He really got away with it, didn't he? He got away with a stamp. Yeah. And then obviously, Aubameyang's miss, which we've just spoken about. Apparently, he's not going to face any charges for that stamp, which is a bit bizarre, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, certain clubs, certain teams, certain players have got different rules still, as we know.
Oh, come on. Are you suggesting that Spurs are receiving preferential treatment from the FA or the Premier League?
I didn't say that. You're putting words into my mouth.
You're suggesting it.
if Harry Kane could score a ghost goal and claim it, why can Sanchez not be banned? So, you know, I mean, surely the FA have looked at it. It's a deliberate stamp. That is an automatic red card if the referee sees it, and it should be a 3-game ban. I thought the rules were that if the referee or the officials miss an incident and he's not booked in a game, then when they review it afterwards, then he should get banned. So I like to know these people that sit on the panel or look or make these decisions and go, no, no, we'll let him off. I mean, I don't understand it. Everybody that knows football knows what's happened. So, you know, like we said, it's a bizarre decision. And Sanchez on the day didn't really have a great game either. I thought he was pulled left, right and centre by the Arsenal front three. So he had a shocker on Saturday for me.
Excellent. Right, moving on. Arsenal's draw meant Manchester United had to beat Southampton to get back into the top four, which they did. But it wasn't easy, was it, Rod?
No, it's, you know, it's, you get this sometimes when teams come to Old Trafford or teams play United, they play the games of life. Why are Southampton down there? I do not know, because you know the way that they played, they give us problems. They worked hard. They looked a threat. It's just defensively that they let themselves down. You know. It's just, I just can't believe it. This just puzzles me out how a team like that can perform like that.
Well, it's because they had Mark Hughes in charge, that's why.
possibly, but, you know, it was the one that it was lucky to get out with the 3 points, really. One of them is where, really, they probably deserved something out of the game, but, you know, at Old Trafford, we pulled it out in the last few minutes, and keeps the run going, and it keeps Ollie at the wheel.
Absolutely. And Michael Ralph Hasenhüttl told the BBC that his team deserved more. Were Southampton unfortunate not to come away with at least a point?
Yeah, I think they were. I mean, I was. I agree with Rod there. I think Southampton's situation baffles me, but it also goes down to two completely sort of ends of the table, so to speak, which is exactly what we're talking about. But the atmosphere that has happened at United with Solskjaer's introduction and whatever he is doing behind the scenes is completely contrary to what was happening during Mark Hughes's reign. But I think that Hasenhüttl has done an incredibly impressive job to, you know, stop the bleeding, even though they're still close to it. But if they play like they did in the first half specifically, and some of the things they were doing from the press, you know, as a collective group, individually, I thought their standard was very high, and it does baffle me why they're where they are. But the reality is you are where your position is. That's just the way it is. And you can talk about, oh, we're better than that, we're better than that. But unless you can produce some form of consistent performances, you're going to stay where you are. And the reality is they did not, you know, sort of execute in the critical areas at the critical time with the critical ability. And there you go. But yeah, I thought a draw would have been fair, but you have to take your hat off to Manchester United again and Solskjaer's regime and what they're doing. And they seem to be, you know, so upbeat, you know, compared to what they've been over the last little while that they probably deserved what they ended up getting at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And our mate Romelu Lukaku scored another brace. This is his second in a row. Whisper it quietly, but he's close to hitting top form again, isn't he? He's not quite the comedian as people made him out to be. Not like John Candy, who's another Canadian, by the way.
You would ask me the Lukaku question, won't you?
Why not?
I think you did that deliberately, didn't you? Listen, you got to give him credit for what he's done. I mean, the one thing I'm never going to criticise Lukaku is his attitude and the fact that when he does put on the shirt, he does try. Now, regardless if we've got our opinions about him or not, at least the geezer tries, and I'll give him credit for that. And you know what? When we've needed him the last 2-3 games, you know, to be fair, he stepped up. Palace away was a difficult game, especially with all the injuries. He scored a brace. And he scored a brace the other day to get us out of trouble. So I can't knock a guy that delivers he's delivered lately, when we've actually needed him. It was a weird game, I thought, on Saturday still. I thought United could have easily been 3-0 up in the first 10 minutes. And then Vestergaard had a golden chance that he should have scored to put Southampton ahead. I think Southampton had good shouts for at least a couple of penalties. On another day, they really should be given. Then they take the lead. United take the lead again. And then Southampton equalise. And then it looked like Southampton, like, were the team that had the incentive to go and win the game. And then as you said, Lukaku pops up in the last minute. And he scored two with his right foot as well, which is a collector's item.
Absolutely. And Michael, Chelsea beat Fulham 2-1 to close the gap between them and United 2 points. Jorginho and Higuain got on the score sheet, both of whom were signed by Sarri. Obviously, he knows them from his time at Napoli, so it's almost as if he's going back to the future, like Michael J. Fox, who was born where?
Canada.
There you go, see? Chelsea have a game in hand, win that, and they're back in the top four. Question is, will they stay there if they get there?
You know, Chelsea is so such a difficult one to measure from my point of view. You know, their inconsistency, probably more importantly, the drama that seems to occur around them. You know, there's no doubt. You know, there's quality there. I think in the end of the day, if they can get some consistent service for Higuain, he'll score goals. There is no doubt about that. But it was interesting how, you know, euphoric they looked when they won 2-1. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was like we've stepped over a hurdle, because I think, you know, I think it's been a very difficult time behind the scenes. For a number of different reasons, and this is again a testament to the challenges that the Premier League provide. You know, new managers that are coming in and have to change cultures, and who are trying to apply their own personality on things, and they find it troublesome. Are they going to stay there? In the top four, I'm unsure. If I have to submit my betting slip, I'd say no.
Fair enough. Rod, Scott Parker stepped in as caretaker manager after Ranieri was given the boot, and surprise, surprise, Fulham really put in a shift. I mean, look, their season's been a bigger joke than Tom Green, who was also born in where, Michael?
Canada.
Rod, let's be honest here. It's too little too late for Fulham. They're 10 points behind 18th place. They've got no chance of staying up, do they?
No, they don't. And, you know, it's just one of them decisions again that, you know, I know Claudio Ranieri has won the league with Leicester, and, you know, it's obviously totally different circumstances. And why didn't they give Scott Parker the job then when they gave Claudio Ranieri, and they probably would have had a better chance? Because he knows the club more, he knows what players, what young players he can gamble on, what players and give them 100% and just play for the club and just obviously they've shown that weekend by the work rate that they've given the manager. And yeah, it's just one of the ones that baffles me again, that why didn't they go with the younger English manager instead of the easy option foreign manager.
They really went for it against Chelsea, though, didn't they? I know Mitrovic had a couple of chances. Ryan Babel looked like the Ryan Babel of old. Even Callum Chambers got on the score sheet. So he's obviously doing something right. But again, it's too little too late. They're going to be preparing for next season, obviously. But yeah, it would be interesting to see if he's going to get the job full time.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, he could still go on like a run like, you know, Darren Morgan at the end of the season, still do very well, and then win himself a contract and win himself the manager's job. But, you know, it'd be very, very difficult. What are the games they've got left? 8, 9, 10 games? It'd be very, very difficult to claw them points back. So it probably is regroup and sort the club out and get it organised for next year and quickly get someone in place. And hopefully Scott Parker is that man, because, you know, he was a good player. He's obviously done a good job where he's been. I think he's been at Tottenham, now he's been at Fulham. So he's obviously knows what he's doing, and it's shown that by the weekend. But, you know, we just have to wait and see. But it'd be very, very difficult for him to stay up now.
Yeah. I just got a question. The owner's, I don't know, plans or agenda when it comes to the club, because we heard the stories about him wanting to buy Wembley Stadium. He's obviously got that NFL side. He's given his son a boatload of money to create a wrestling company. So I just wonder where he's going with Fulham, and Michael's on hold. So I don't know. You still there, Michael?
No, I'm here. I'm still here.
Just lost you for a second. It's all right. So what do you know about the Fulham chairman? Because I know, as I said before, his son is got a wrestling company. He owns an NFL side. He tried to buy Wembley Stadium, or he was reportedly wanting to buy Wembley Stadium. Do you think he'll be there for the long run with Fulham, even if they go down?
I think so in some ways, just because I think they see the opportunity from the corporate side and the business side of what to grow. You have to call into question the entire transition process from the championship level to the Premier League and how they went about their business where they invested and why they invested. I don't know what the number was, but they've put a significant amount of money into the playing staff coming into the Premier League, which a lot of championship teams do if they've got the wallet to back it up. But it's proven to be some real poor decision making, in my opinion. It'll be interesting because it's going to be horses for the courses as they go down, which I think they will. That'll be the test of exactly who they are and what they are at that point.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right, now from the bottom of the table to the top end, Man City sit pretty a point clear after Liverpool were held at Goodison Park. Jan, Klopp's men missed a few gilt-edged chances yesterday, with Mo Salah being the biggest culprit. That's four draws from their last six games, mate, and many Liverpool fans are starting to question the manager as well as their title credentials.
They've been firing a lot of blanks lately as well. I mean,
careful.
it's a weird one still because, the optimistic Liverpool fan would say, well, we've gone away to two of our biggest rivals who would want nothing more for Liverpool not to win the title, and they come away with two clean sheets and not get beat. A negative Liverpool fan would say, well, we've gone to a injury struck Man United and we couldn't beat them, and we've gone to Everton who have been poor all season, and we couldn't beat them either. So it just depends on what way you look at it. Listen, let's face it: for Liverpool to still be up there and doing what they're doing with Man City spending all this money over the years, you got to give them credit for what they've done. Even if they don't win the league this year, they've been really good. They've been entertaining. They've kept up with City. It's only until yesterday that actually City have gone above them with the same amount of games. So, I think they've done really, really well. And who says they can't still win the league? But sometimes you've got, with Liverpool, especially now with the fans, are they going to start questioning Klopp if they don't win it? The fact that it will be his fourth year now and he hasn't won a trophy there? So
yeah, but shouldn't they? Why shouldn't they question him? The amount of money he's spent this summer, if they don't win anything this season, why shouldn't they question him? I know that, listen, all these radio shows last night were having Liverpool fans calling up saying, oh, some of them were saying he's not the right man. Another one called up and he made a good point about there being progress. But exactly how long must the progress cycle be before you actually start winning things and start judging the guy? I know it's easy for me to say Mourinho came in and won two trophies in his first season and Klopp has lost three finals. But let's be 100% honest, mate. They were 7 points clear at one point in the season. And they could have gone 10 had they beaten Man City. Now, they're chasing them.
Now they're chasing them.
So why shouldn't they question the manager?
Like I said, it is a difficult one because at the end of the day, no matter how much progress they have made under him, it is all about trophies, isn't it? So I guess Liverpool fans have got a right to say, well, yeah, he makes us play pretty football. Yeah, we've progressed under him, but we might want a manager that actually wins us something. So it is difficult still because, like with us with Mourinho, yeah, he won two trophies in his first season and then Mourinho digressed after that, in my opinion. Whilst with Klopp, they have improved year on year, year in, but they haven't won anything. So do they keep faith with him with the fact that eventually he might win them a trophy, or the fact that now that they've progressed under him, they get a more maybe ruthless manager or more of a winner manager that will take them to the next step? It's a difficult one still.
So basically you're running the risk of being tagged the next entertainers like Kevin Keegan's Newcastle, who played expansive football. They're really pretty, won the hearts of everyone with the style of play and all the players that they've brought in, but then they won nada. So then what?
Well, then I guess he's got a goal, because at the end of the day, Liverpool are a massive club and they want to win trophies. But do you give him another year? Do you give him, you know, another centre-half to play with Van Dijk, and then they become stronger in that department? I mean, all right, yeah, they have spent money, but they haven't spent the money, say, United have spent or City have spent over the years. So if he had that abundance of money, where would he have taken Liverpool? So, again, he is in the mold of what I think with Pochettino, where Pochettino's worked wonders at Tottenham, but he's never won nothing either because of the budget he's got there. So, like I said, for me, Snow, it's a difficult one because, you know, I'm undecided. If I was a Liverpool fan, I'd sit with Klopp, hoping that the fact that they've progressed under him, they might go one better. But then if next year they don't win it, or say they don't win it this year either, then maybe it is time for a change.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that they should get rid of him, but the way I see it, they should be well clear by now. I know we've seen teams crumble. You know, United have done it, Arsenal have done it, Newcastle have done it. Every major club has done it. But the way I see it, right now the players, they're not playing a style. Okay, they are trying to play a style, but they're not playing the way that they have done all season. We knew that was going to happen. We knew that eventually they're going to start looking leg. I mean, look at Mo Salah. The bloke had two great chances. You say, I don't know, players miss chances. You can't, all right, it's not fair for me to you know, lambast him for it. But the way I see it, if this is a fit Mo Salah, he's putting that ball in the back of the net. Both of them. Mm. So,
They rely too much on the front three still. They've done that for the last 2 years. I mean, when Origi and Sturridge come in, they're not the same kind of quality as your Mane and your Firmino. And the problem for me at Liverpool is the lack of goals or the lack of creativity they have in the middle of the park. For me, I mean, Fabinho for me has been a really good signing. He sits in front of that back four and he kind of dictates play and he gives a lot of protection to the defence. Hence the fact that they've conceded, I think, the least goals in the Premiership this season.
Mm.
But then after that, Gini Wijnaldum, he's not an attacking midfielder. He's not a defensive midfielder. He's just a solid midfield player. Jordan Henderson is a workhorse. He's never going to get you goals or create much. So if the front three are going to fire blanks, where are the goals going to come from then? And you've seen that, you know, with Bayern, with United, with Everton, where they haven't scored, because when the front three haven't scored, nobody else has contributed. So for me, that if there's one area that he would like to, you know, maybe improve, you know, there's an argument that if Oxlade-Chamberlain there, they might have given him, you know, he might have given Liverpool something different, but he's not there. So they've lacked that creativity in the middle of the park.
Well, they've got Adam Lallana. He gives them creativity. Look, the way I see it, the next 10 days are going to be massive for Liverpool season because they've got Burnley next, which is never going to be an easy game. I know it's going to be at home, but it's never going to be an easy game. Then they've got Bayern Munich. Now, Bayern ran into the ground the other week. So, I don't know. This could be massive from confidence-wise as well. But, Michael, let's talk quickly about Jurgen Klopp. I mean, he said the wind affected Liverpool's play. Now, you can add this to the list of excuses given in the last couple of years, which include dry grass, snow, his players having sore throats, opponents having injuries, and even BT Sports for not allowing the referee to add more than 4 minutes in stoppage time. Is the gegenpress king cracking up? Is he feeling the pressure?
Well, I mean, I guess you have to define pressure in some ways. I think managers at this level, some have a very good way about them to be able to deflect the story. And I mean, I think Jurgen Klopp is one of his best traits is to be able to control the narrative. And, you know, you look on the weekend, whether it's, you know, wind or what. And by the way, if there was any conditions I hated to play in, it was wind. I don't know about you guys, but I hated wind. But, I mean, he changed the story, you know, and what he wanted to do is, I think, take a lot of the stress out of the players because you could see it in the players' face. At the end of the game, they knew they've tripped up, and they've tripped up badly, and it could cost them because Man City is not the type of team that I would like to have to chase. I would rather them having them chase me, which would expose them. Having them in the control seat now, I think they all know they've put themselves in a terrible position. But with Klopp, he's there to deflect from that. He's there to protect the players, and he can do that by controlling the narrative with some of the things that he says. And I think at the end of the day, you're right. I think the next 10 days are massive for them. I think they are seeing some of the frailties in putting so much emphasis on their front three. And as Jan was saying there, their game does not has not been built around any sort of type of link type midfield. You know, they bypass that line. They want the game farther up the field quicker, so they don't need that type of player. They need the Fabinho type player who sits and protects, you know, anything that comes back the other way. So they'd have to change a lot, but I think what they really needed was a little extra in their front attack to take some of the pressure off that three. But from a Klopp point of view, I'm unsure. He doesn't come across as someone here who reacts and feels that stress and pressure. He's done that quite well. He's got a great man management style. But now it's down to the players' ability to execute here in the next couple of days, weeks.
And Rod, it's something that we spoke about weeks ago, in the sense that, you know, Pep Guardiola, he's never been used to chasing a title. He's always been at the top and have people chasing after him. And we always said that his main challenge would be to overtake Liverpool. Well, he's done that. Now, Liverpool are in a position that they haven't been in all season, whereas they're doing the chasing. Do you think the pressure is going to get to them, or is it just the fact that they're just mentally drained? Because we saw against United the other week, they weren't great. I know they battered Watford midweek, but Watford hardly put up a challenge. But Everton was a really difficult game. Burnley will be a difficult one. Bayern will be a difficult one. So where do you see this going? Are they in trouble?
Liverpool, you would think so, because, you know, you see people look at, okay, let's see what fixtures Manchester City have got, and let's see what fixtures. It doesn't matter now, you know. All these games now are very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. They're coming thick and fast. You know, some teams have had a long rest, and you've just been playing 3 days, every 3 days, and you come against a team out of nowhere that you think you're expected to win, like a naive Burnley on the weekend. So, you know, every game's a difficult, and I think if Liverpool drop any more points, and if City get even points, so if City lose another game, if Liverpool lose another game and City win, it becomes 4 points, then it's curtains, and it could be like, they could win by 10 or 12, because, you know, if City look like they're in a roll now, they've grinded a win out against Bournemouth, with minimal chances created for Bournemouth. All right, it was an exciting game, but you're not going to get them every game. You grind out 1-0 away. Brilliant. You can see that the way Pep was so pleased with it, with his team after the game. So, you know, Liverpool are going to struggle now. And you know, for me, it's City will win by a clear 8 or 9 points, to be honest.
And they're doing it with a half-fit De Bruyne. He's got that chronic knee injury, isn't he? Is it a knee injury, I think he's got? Is it a knee injury? I don't know.
He looked like he went off in the weekend with more of a muscle situation, but it's probably related.
Yeah, I think it's a hammy, I think, apparently. Yeah, hamstring injury.
Yeah, they're muscle ones now at this time of season. You know, you've got to look after him, because if it proper goes, you're looking at 6 to 8 weeks, then the season's over. So. Yeah.
What did you lot make of the stats that show Bournemouth didn't have a shot on goal and they didn't have a corner? I think they had like 18% possession. A lot of people were saying, you know, it's a disgrace. Eddie Howe shouldn't have played that system. He should have been more attack-minded. But I'm not one to stick up for Eddie Howe. You know how I feel about him. But I don't blame the guy. His team just got hammered at Arsenal. They conceded 4 at Old Trafford. They conceded 5 at Wembley against Spurs. What they expect him to do, to go full pelt against Man City to lose 5 or 6-0? I don't understand.
I mean, I laugh, quite frankly, when you get pundits and fans and saying, you know, like, you know, why don't you go run and gun Man City? You know, the realities are, as you say, after an Arsenal a game, and then they come into that situation. The last thing they want to do is get a hiding again. You know, they've set up in a way that they were going to, you know, stave off, you know, any real danger. And I just think it's a reality of teams who end up playing Man City at this moment in time. It seems to be just a function of what is required, because you're not going to dominate the ball. You know it. I mean, that's a reality. And if you are, Man City's had an incredible, terrible day, which is very rare. So what's your next thought, right? So, you know, it certainly wasn't pretty, but I guess at the end of the day, it's all that was needed. And Bournemouth doesn't get, you know, necessarily get embarrassed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Michael, Brendan Rodgers' first game in charge for Leicester ended in defeat. Were you surprised he left Celtic for the Foxes, and how far do you think he can take them?
I'm not surprised. I mean, I think Brendan Rodgers, I mean, I think he had sort of seen what was possible in the Scottish Premier League, and you know, the club has the resources and to dominate that league, you know, on an ongoing basis. I don't think he ever felt he had the capabilities of the depth to make any sort of great effect on European football. I think at the end of the day, Brendan always wanted to return to the Premier League. I think he has something to prove to himself. I think he has something to prove to his naysayers due to his departure from the Premier League. In terms of how far they will go, you know, he's going into a pretty good setup. It's a very well run club now. The investment has been applied appropriately. I think his biggest challenge is really going to be what has been the challenge around Leicester ever since they won it, is you know, who are they? What is their identity, and exactly what is their game model? Because you know, that sort of counter-attack action and high tempo and that type of thing certainly doesn't necessarily fit Brendan's world, but you always got to sort of apply yourself to what you have from a playing staff point of view. So I think his biggest challenge is in the culture of the club and what they really want to be. And that may take a little time. And as long as he doesn't get caught up in a relegation type atmosphere or battle, you know, he'll start to apply himself over time and see what sort of position they are. But they've always seemed to be, to me anyway, a mid-table type team.
That's right. Jan, Watford's winner, did that remind you of the playoff game in 2013 where they went out?
No, but when Nockrat missed the penalty and then Dana scored the winner.
That's probably one of the best playoff matches I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But yeah, what
the finale to that game. That's one of Zola's greatest moments as a manager, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. Rod, you remember that one?
What's that, sorry?
The Watford-Leicester game from back in 2013, the playoff game.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible. Michael, I don't even remember this one. Leicester went into the second leg. It was a two-leg game. They won the first leg 1-0, and then they went to Vicarage Road. It was 2-1 to Watford. They led 2-2 on aggregate, wasn't it, at the time? And then Leicester got a penalty at the last minute. Almunia saved it, and Watford went up the other end and scored. And it was literally last minute. That's what happened to Leicester at the weekend. Last minute goal.
When you review it, you look for the reasoning behind that. I don't know what they were doing. I don't know what Schmeichel was thinking. He knows it's, you know, 90+4 or whatever it was. It was very close to that. And you could see the look on the rest of the players' faces going, you know, what are you doing? You could kill the game off here. And if you are going to release pressure, at least release it into areas there's more people and more players around the ball and a sideline to deal with, not literally up the gut.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Right, in other news, Jan's opinion that Serie A is a glorified SPL was enhanced last night after Juve beat Napoli 2-1 to go 16 points clear at the top. Jan, let's ignore this story because it's pointless discussing it. Talk to me about Fabio Cagliarello, at 26 years old, at 36 years
36.
Old, 36, yeah. Yeah, my bad, is now level with Ronaldo in the goal-scoring charts with 19. Pretty impressive, no?
very impressive, mate. Very impressive. The guy's 36, still playing at the top level in Serie A, which Serie A, for me, has improved. All right, forget Juventus run away with it every year, but the league has improved as a whole. He's playing for Sampdoria, who are not obviously the, you know, the most glorified clubs now in Italy, and he's still banging in the goals. And, you know, it just shows what hard work, dedication, right attitude, mentality, you know, and he's still eager to play and produce, and he's doing it on a regular basis. So full credit to him.
That's right. And Lazio pummeled Roma 3-0 in the Rome derby on Saturday and are now 3 points behind their rivals, 6 behind Inter. Do you think Inzaghi can do the unthinkable and get them in the Champions League?
Yeah, why not still? I mean,
I don't know, I'm asking you.
Yeah, I'm answering. We all know the problems at Inter Milan at the moment with Icardi. I think he's gone 6 games without playing there. So there's definitely problems at Inter with Nainggolan, Icardi, players like that. You know, and also Roma are Jekyll and Hyde. You don't know what you're going to get out of Roma. They can go, you know, away to Milan and beat them 3-0, and they can lose at home to Sassuolo, you know, 3-0. They're that kind of team. They're very unpredictable. So if Lazio are out of the Europa League now, so, you know, they've only got the league to concentrate on. And with a run at the moment, I mean, they've got Casado and Immobile, who are playing quite well as a partnership, and they're scoring goals. So why not? Of course it can.
Great stuff. Now, another major title appears to be wrapped up. This time we cross over to Spain, where Barcelona were victorious in El Clásico. Rod, last week we spoke about Leo Messi and where Barcelona will be when he eventually hangs up his boots or leaves the club. I don't know about you, but it just feels that the fixture's lost a lot of his magic now that Real Madrid are kind of in transition. What do you reckon?
Yeah, it doesn't help with it being on
11 sports. Yeah.
It doesn't help being on 11 sports because no one really. I know I am. I don't really go out of my way to watch it. If it's on Sky Sports and it was always well promoted and well documented, so you'd always watch it. But yeah, it was always a ball fest. Then you always get a couple that now again like a 4-3 or an exciting one. But ultimately, they'd usually a ball fest. And now with the big names, especially Ronaldo going. And Barcelona really walking away. That obviously it's like a transitional period and really struggling, really. And, you know, the Real Madrid fans are at it again, booing their own players that have won the Champions League.
Yeah, how do you feel about that? Because it's Gareth Bale they target this time. Or should I say target him again?
Yeah, well, they've got an history of it, haven't they? The guys scored umpteen goals for him and, you know, the white Yankees come out, they're booing and whatever they do. But yeah, they're spoiled lot. And for someone who's basically won and two Champions League medals, or was it three? But three, himself, especially with the overhead kick that he pulled out, was just amazing. But yeah, to treat one of your stars like that is just, it's just no need. It just lacks a bit of class.
Absolutely. And Michael, Jose Mourinho, he preys on Ivan Rakitic. Do you agree that the Croat is highly underrated?
Yeah, I do, absolutely. I mean, you look at him and the role that he plays at Barcelona. I mean, it's no secret, you know why he plays where he plays, because of Messi. And that area of the pitch that needs to be dominated by somebody. But, I mean, you have to remember, I mean, he played 100-plus games, I think it was, for Sevilla. You know, he played close to 100-plus games for Schalke. He's played 150-plus games for Barcelona. I mean, the time that this guy spent contributing in a big way to every team he's been on is extremely impressive. I've spent time with the Croatian staff and their ex staff in before the Brazil World Cup, and you know they couldn't say enough about how important he was to the entire setup, and you know we see his performances on the pitch and his ability to create tempo and pick out the right path. He's got great range, but even off the field, he's an incredibly impressive guy, supposedly, in terms of his influence on the group. And I think that bears fruit by the amount of games he's played for the teams that he's played with. So, no, I'll agree with my friend Jose there on this occasion.
Fantastic. Right, gents.
By the way, yep. By the way, who was not born in Canada?
Oh, I was just about to Google it as well.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Brilliant. Right, we don't have a game this week, unfortunately, but we do have Eurotrash.
And now it's time for Eurotrash.
So again, it's the best of the worst. I've got three stories from Europe this week, and you guys need to choose which is the best of the worst. I think I know which one's going to win, but let's just go for it anyway. Now, we knew Mario Balotelli would make an appearance on Eurotrash sooner or later. Super Mario came up with a modern and innovative goal celebration after putting Marseille in front against Saint-Étienne. The former Man City striker was handed a mobile phone by a photographer and streamed his celebration on Instagram Live. Something tells me Jesse Lingard, Paul Pogba and Mesut Ozil are upset they didn't think of that. Our next story comes from Turkey. This is just for you, Michael, because I know you like Turkish football. Where a third division player is accused of attacking an opponent with a razor blade during a match. Ahmed SK player Masakala is alleged to have cut Sakaryaspor player Ferhat Yazgan before kickoff and during the game. Now, Yazgan took to social media at full time, posting images of cuts on his neck. Meanwhile, Ahmed SK officials deny the claims and are accusing their opponents of trying to slander the club with baseless claims. Oh, that's like knife crime. I don't know what's so baseless about it. Story number three isn't really funny, but it comes from Bolton, where today the club shut its training ground and advised all staff to stay at home because they ran out of food and drink. Bolton's owner Ken Anderson has put up the club for sale, but sources say many members of staff haven't been paid their February wages, and some are even asking for small cash amounts just to buy food. Right, best of the worst. Rod?
Bolton, we've seen it before, you know, it's embarrassing to even talk about that. You know, another owner just neglecting his employees. You know, the club not getting paid on time, it's just, we've heard that before, so. It's got to be the Turkish one, raise the pitch.
Yeah, so he had a razor blade. Apparently, you know when they shake hands before the game? Apparently, as he was running off, because, you know, obviously they shake the hands of the away team.
No, I know. I've actually read the story, because when I was reading it, it was either yesterday or today. I was actually reading it, and I was reading it thinking, I bet Stale mentions that.
Had to be done.
So, it'd have to be that one. Mm. Razor blade. Actually, what's he doing with him on the pitch?
Bonkers, absolutely
just crazy.
Bonkers.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. And what was the other one?
Oh, the other one was Balotelli. Yeah.
Oh, Balotelli, that was brilliant. That's brilliant. You know, obviously, if you was the manager, you wouldn't be too pleased about it. But I'm not sure wouldn't be that bothered if you won. But you know, it's modern day life now. And he's obviously brought his phone out, give it a cameraman for a score. You know, I like his confidence, thinking that he was going to score. So yeah.
Like Totti's done that before.
Yeah, he took a photograph, didn't he? Yeah.
What, live stream on Instagram?
No, I took a photograph. He did a selfie.
That's right, yeah.
But can you imagine like giving that phone to the photographer? He must really trust him. Or he didn't give him the pin to his phone, because I can't imagine what Balotelli's got on his phone, especially in the camera roll bit, you know?
I don't think Balotelli comes across the type of person that don't really care.
Here's the pin. I have some photographs of myself. Do what you want with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joy. Jan, which one are you picking? As if I didn't know.
It's got to be the razor, mate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be, innit?
Okay. Well, you know how to use a razor, don't you? I mean, you need a shave.
He probably nicked mine. I've been using mine for about a month. So I was wondering where he went.
He's using a cutthroat these days. Really are. Michael?
Oh, well. I don't know why you're all so surprised at Turkish football, right? It is a land of surprises. Every game, every level. I mean, there's always something happening in Turkish football. I have to say, I'm incredibly impressed with Turkish football fans' passion. It's just amazing when you see it. But that is absolutely horrendous. Balotelli doesn't surprise me at all. He could, But it's interesting. I find it, when I saw it, I was more impressed that he could use the phone because he couldn't put a penny on before. So obviously if he's graduated to some other level that he can use his cell phone to do live streaming. And before a game, he doesn't know how to put a penny on. So that's incredible. Did you ever see that footage?
Yeah, we were struggling in the training, wasn't he?
Oh my God, unbelievable. One of the funniest things. And if you're in a coaching staff and you see stuff like that happen, you're either really committed to make sure no one sees it or you just want to see them flounder. So, but and the Bolton situation is just sad. I mean, it's just, it's so unfortunate in this day and age that, you know, a club, or any club that you know has supposed you know ownership and commitment to a community can let a club get to this point, and I think it's just an overall sad story.
That's right. Well, going back to Turkish football, I don't know if you remember Les Ferdinand when he's telling the story about his time at Beşiktaş. He on his debut, they sacrificed the lamb on the pitch.
Honestly, okay, you should do a whole story, a whole show on Turkish football. The stories are endless about those types of things and you know, quote, we'll say it, witchcraft type activities before the game. And
what about Graham Souness when he put the Galatasaray flag in the middle of the Fenerbahce pitch?
That was on, somebody posted on the internet the other day a Graham Souness, you know, best of, which was basically the first touch was a tackle in everyone. But the flag thing was amazing. I mean, and the afters that happened in that game, I think they were blocked in the stadium for like hours after the game because they couldn't get out because of that action.
Yeah, I remember Graham Souness was a manager. He was this really strong character. I mean, he still is now, but I can just imagine when he was at Benfica, you know, when they get that eagle to fly around the stadium before every game, he's probably like, nah, I'm taking that home. I'm taking that. That's mine.
But I have to say one other thing before you go is you were talking about the Clásico. What's interesting, I'm hearing you talk about the fact that the exposure levels and you know, broadcast and media and, you know, people don't get an opportunity to see it necessarily. I also find it interesting that there is so many leagues around the world that are using that phrase now to describe matches. And whenever I remember the Clásico, there was only one, and that was Real Madrid and Barcelona. Now you'll get leagues around the world using it to describe local rivalries or using not necessarily El Clásico, they may use La, Al, but they use that term. And I think you're right, it's lost a little bit of its luster from a global perspective. I don't think you could say that to the Barcelona or Real Madrid fans, but yeah, definitely it doesn't have the same flavor it used to in that regard.
Are you saying it's lost its mojo?
Oh boy, could do.
Yeah, and do you know who said that?
No.
Mike Myers?
There you go.
Another Canadian. Canada. We did it. We did one more before we ended the show.
One more.
That's it. Great stuff. Well, gents, thank you ever so much for your time. It's been great having you guys on. Hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I have. Follow you guys go. Twitter handles. Rod?
Rod James Giggs.
Superb. Jan?
Yannick Kiss J.
Michael?
I don't even know what my Twitter handle is, actually. They always can get me at michaelfinleyfootball.com. Super. And they'll find me somewhere.
There you go. He pulled out a hat just when he
did. under extreme pressure like Jurgen Klopp.
You're not going to blame the wind for that, though, are you?
No.
Superb. Well, guys, as you're still listening, we have a Twitter handle at Shoot Defense. I hope you're enjoying the videos that we're uploading for past goals and previous strikers. I don't know if you guys have been watching them, but I've been putting up Serie A goals and all these goals from the 90s and whatnot. And I put one up from Alvaro Recoba. I don't know if you guys remember him. Wonderful.
The Uruguayan left foot rocket.
Yep. We got fantastic footballer back then. But yeah, so yeah, follow us on Twitter at Shoot Defense. We have a Facebook group page. And that's it for us this week. So until next time, guys, take care.